Murdstone, beckoning me aside into a window. A word! I confronted Miss Murdstone alone. David Copperfield, said Miss Murdstone, I need not enlarge upon family circumstances. They are not a tempting subject. Far from it, ma'am, I returned. Far from it, assented Miss Murdstone. I do not wish to revive the memory of past differences or of past outrages. I have received outrages from a person, a female, I'm sorry to say, for the credit of my sex, who is not to be mentioned without scorn and disgust, and therefore I would rather not mention her. I felt very fiery on my aunt's account, but I said it would certainly be better if Miss Murdstone pleased not to mention her. I could not hear her disrespectfully mentioned, I added, without expressing my opinion in a decided tone. Miss Murdstone shut her eyes and disdainfully inclined her head, then, slowly opening her eyes, resumed, David Copperfield, I shall not attempt to disguise the fact that I formed an unfavourable opinion of you in your childhood. It may have been a mistaken one, or you may have ceased to justify it. That is not in question between us now. I belong to a family remarkable, I believe, for some firmness, and I am not the creature of circumstance or change. I may have my opinion of you, you may have your opinion of me. I inclined my head in my turn. But it is not necessary, said Miss Murdstone, that these opinions should come into collision here. Under existing circumstances, it is as well on all accounts that they should not, as the chances of life have brought us together again, and may bring us together on other occasions. I would say, let us meet here as distant acquaintances. Family circumstances are a sufficient reason for our only meeting on that footing, and it is quite unnecessary that either of us should make the other the subject of remark. Do you approve of this? Miss Murdstone, I returned, I think you and Mr. Murdstone used me very cruelly and treated my mother with great unkindness. I shall always think so as long as I live. But I quite agree in what you propose. Miss Murdstone shut her eyes again and bent her head. Then, just touching the back of my hand with the tips of her cold, stiff fingers, she walked away, arranging the little fetters on her wrists and round her neck, which seemed to be the same set, in exactly the same state as when I had seen her last. These reminded me, in reference to Miss Murdstone's nature, of the fetters over a jail door, suggesting on the outside to all beholders what was to be expected within.
This ends side one of cassette 13. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
All I know of the rest of the evening is that I heard the Empress of my heart sing enchanted ballads in the French language, generally to the effect that whatever was the matter, we ought always to dance, ta-la-la, ta-la-la, accompanying herself on a glorified instrument resembling a guitar. That I was lost in blissful delirium, that I refused refreshment, that my soul recoiled from punch particularly, that when Miss Murdstone took her into custody and led her away, she smiled and gave me her delicious hand, that I caught a view of myself in a mirror looking perfectly imbecile and idiotic, that I retired to bed in a most maudlin state of mind and got up in a crisis of feeble infatuation. It was a fine morning and early, and I thought I'd go and take a stroll down one of those wire-arched walks and indulge my passion by dwelling on her image. On my way through the hall, I encountered her little dog, who was called Jip, short for Gypsy. I approached him tenderly, for I loved even him, but he showed his whole set of teeth, got under a chair expressly to snarl, and wouldn't hear of the least familiarity. The garden was cool and solitary. I walked about, wondering what my feelings of happiness would be if I could ever become engaged to this dear wonder. As to marriage and fortune and all that, I believe I was almost as innocently undesigning then as when I loved little Emily. to be allowed to call her Dora, to write to her, to dote upon and worship her, to have reason to think that when she was with other people she was yet mindful of me, seemed to me the summit of human ambition. I'm sure it was the summit of mine. There's no doubt whatever that I was a lackadaisical young spoony, but there was a purity of heart in all this still that prevents my having quite a contemptuous recollection of it, let me laugh as I may. I'd not been walking long when I turned a corner and met her. I tingle again from head to foot as my recollection turns that corner, and my pen shakes in my hand. "You are out early, Miss Spenlow," said I. "It's so stupid at home," she replied, "and Miss Murdstone is so absurd. She talks such nonsense about its being necessary for the day to be aired before I come out." "Aired!" she laughed here in the most melodious manner. "On a Sunday morning, when I don't practice, I must do something. So I told Papa last night I must come out. Besides, it's the brightest time of the whole day, don't you think so?" I hazarded a bold flight and said, not without stammering, that it was very bright to me then, though it had been very dark to me a minute before. "Do you mean a compliment," said Dora, "or that the weather has really changed?" I stammered worse than before, in replying that I meant no compliment but the plain truth, though I was not aware of any change having taken place in the weather. "It was in the state of my own feelings," I added bashfully, to clench the explanation. "I never saw such curls." How could I, for there never were such curls, as those she shook out to hide her blushes. As to the straw hat and blue ribbons which was on top of the curls, if I could only have hung it up in my room in Buckingham Street, what a priceless possession it would have been. "You've just come home from Paris," said I. "Yes," said she. "Have you ever been there?"
"No."
"Oh, I hope you'll go soon. You'd like it so much." Traces of deep-seated anguish appeared in my countenance. That she should hope I would go, that she should think it possible I could go, was insupportable. I depreciated Paris, I depreciated France. I said I wouldn't leave England under existing circumstances for any earthly consideration. Nothing should induce me. In short, she was shaking the curls again when the little dog came running along the walk to our relief. He was mortally jealous of me, and persisted in barking at me. She took him up in her arms, oh my goodness, and caressed him. But he insisted upon barking still. He wouldn't let me touch him when I tried, and then she beat him. It increased my sufferings greatly to see the pats she gave him for punishment on the bridge of his blunt nose, while he winked his eyes and licked her hand, and still growled within himself like a little double bass. At length he was quiet. Well, he might be, with her dimpled chin upon his head. And we walked away to look at a greenhouse. "You're not very intimate with Miss Murdstone, are you?" said Dora. "My pet." The last two words were to the dog. Oh, if they'd only been to me. "No," I replied, "not at all, sir." "She is a tiresome creature," said Dora, pouting. "I can't think what Papa can have been about when he chose such a vexatious thing to be my companion. Who wants a protector? I'm sure I don't want a protector. Jip can protect me a great deal better than Miss Murdstone, can't you, Jip, dear?" He only winked lazily when she kissed his ball of a head. "Papa calls her my confidential friend, but I'm sure she's no such thing, is she, Jip? We're not going to confide in any such cross people, Jip and I. We mean to bestow our confidence where we like, and to find out our own friends instead of having them found out for us, don't we, Jip?" Jip made a comfortable noise in answer, a little like a tea kettle when it sings. As for me, every word was a new heap of fetters riveted above the last. "It's very hard, because we have not a kind mamma that we are to have instead a sulky, gloomy old thing like Miss Murdstone always following us about, isn't it, Jip?" "Never mind, Jip. We won't be confidential, and we'll make ourselves as happy as we can in spite of her, and we'll tease her and not please her, won't we, Jip?" If it had lasted any longer, I think I must have gone down on my knees on the gravel, with the probability before me of grazing them, and of being presently ejected from the premises besides. But by good fortune the greenhouse was not far off, and these words brought us to it. It contained quite a show of beautiful geraniums. We loitered along in front of them, And Dora often stopped to admire this one or that one, and I stopped to admire the same one, and Dora, laughing, held the dog up childishly to smell the flowers. And if we were not all three in Fairyland, certainly I was. The scent of a geranium leaf at this day strikes me with a half-comical, half-serious wonder as to what change has come over me in a moment. And then I see a straw hat and blue ribbons and a quantity of curls and a little black dog being held up in two slender arms against a bank of blossoms and bright leaves. Miss Murdstone had been looking for us. She found us here and presented her uncongenial cheek, the little wrinkles in it filled with hair powder, to Dora to be kissed. Then she took Dora's arm in hers and marched us into breakfast as if it were a soldier's funeral. How many cups of tea I drank because Dora made it, I don't know. But I perfectly remember that I sat swilling tea until my whole nervous system, if I'd had any in those days, must have gone by the board. By and by we went to church. Miss Murdstone was between Dora and me in the pew, but I heard her sing, and the congregation vanished. A sermon was delivered, about Dora, of course, and I'm afraid that is all I know of the service. We had a quiet day, no company, a walk, a family dinner of four, and an evening of looking over books and pictures, Miss Murdstone with a homily before her and her eye upon us, keeping guard vigilantly. Ah, little did Mr. Spenlow imagine when he sat opposite to me after dinner that day with his pocket handkerchief over his head, how fervently I was embracing him in my fancy as his son-in-law. Little did he think when I took leave of him at night that he had just given his full consent to my being engaged to Dora, and that I was invoking blessings on his head. We departed early in the morning, for we had a salvage case coming on in the Admiralty Court, requiring a rather accurate knowledge of the whole science of navigation, in which, as we couldn't be expected to know much about those matters in the Commons, the judge had entreated two old Trinity masters for charity's sake to come and help him out. Dora was at the breakfast table to make the tea again, however, and I had the melancholy pleasure of taking off my hat to her in the phaeton as she stood on the doorstep with Jip in her arms. What the Admiralty was to me that day, what nonsense I made of our case in my mind as I listened to it, how I saw Dora engraved upon the blade of the silver oar which they lay upon the table as the emblem of that high jurisdiction, and how I felt when Mr. Spenlow went home without me. I'd had an insane hope that he might take me back again, as if I were a mariner myself in the ship to which I belonged and sailed away and left me on a desert island. I shall make no fruitless effort to describe. If that sleepy old court could rouse itself and present in any visible form the daydreams I've had in it about Dora, it would reveal my truth. I don't mean the dreams that I dreamed on that day alone, but day after day, from week to week and term to term, I went there not to attend to what was going on, but to think about Dora. If I ever bestowed a thought upon the cases as they dragged their slow length before me, it was only to wonder in the matrimonial cases, remembering Dora, how it was that married people could ever be otherwise than happy. And in the prerogative cases, to consider if the money in question had been left to me, what were the foremost steps I should immediately have taken in regard to Dora. Within the first week of my passion, I bought four sumptuous waistcoats, not for myself, I had no pride in them, for Dora, and took to wearing straw-coloured kid gloves in the streets, and laid the foundations of all the corns I've ever had. If the boots I wore at that period could only be produced and compared with the natural size of my feet, they would show what the state of my heart was in a most affecting manner. And yet, wretched cripple as I made myself by this act of homage to Dora, I walked miles upon miles daily in the hope of seeing her. Not only was I soon as well known on the Norwood Road as the postman on that beat, but I pervaded London likewise. I walked about the streets where the best shops for ladies were. I haunted the bazaar like an unquiet spirit. I fagged through the park again and again, long after I was quite knocked up. Sometimes, at long intervals and on rare occasions, I saw her. Perhaps I saw her glove waved in a carriage window. Perhaps I met her, walked with her and Miss Murdstone a little way and spoke to her. In the latter case, I was always very miserable afterwards, to think that I had said nothing to the purpose, or that she had no idea of the extent of my devotion, or that she cared nothing about me. I was always looking out, as may be supposed, for another invitation to Mr. Spenlow's house. I was always being disappointed, for I got none. Mrs. Crupp must have been a woman of penetration, for when this attachment was but a few weeks old, and I had not had the courage to write more explicitly even to Agnes than that I had been to Mr. Spenlow's house, whose family, I added, consists of one daughter, I say Mrs. Crupp must have been a woman of penetration, for even in that early stage she found it out. She came up to me one evening when I was very low to ask, she being then afflicted with the disorder I've mentioned, if I could oblige her with a little tincture of cardamoms mixed with rhubarb and flavoured with 7 drops of the essence of cloves, which was the best remedy for her complaint, or if I had not such a thing by me with a little brandy, which was the next best. It was not, she remarked, so palatable to her, but it was the next best. As I had never even heard of the first remedy, and always had the second in the closet, I gave Mrs. Crupp a glass of the second, which, that I might have no suspicion of its being devoted to any improper use, she began to take in my presence. "Cheer up, sir," said Mrs. Crupp. "I can't abear to see you so, sir. I'm a mother myself." I didn't quite perceive the application of this fact to myself, but I smiled on Mrs. Crupp as benignly as was in my power. "Come, sir," said Mrs. Crupp, "excuse me. I know what it is, sir. There's a young lady in the case." "Mrs. Crupp," I returned, reddening. "Oh, bless you. Keep a good heart, sir," said Mrs. Crupp, nodding encouragement. "Never say die, sir. If she don't smile upon you, there's a many as will. You're a young gentleman to be smiled on, Mr. Copperfull, and you must learn your value, sir." Mrs. Crupp always called me Mr. Copperfull. Firstly, no doubt, because it wasn't my name, and secondly, I'm inclined to think in some indistinct association with a washing day. "What makes you suppose there's any young lady in the case, Mrs. Crupp?" said I. "Mr. Copperfull," said Mrs. Crupp with a great deal of feeling, "I'm a mother myself." For some time Mrs. Crupp could only lay her hand upon her nankeen bosom and fortify herself against returning pain with sips of her medicine. At length she spoke again. "When the present set were took for you by your dear aunt, Mr. Copperfull," said Mrs. Crupp, "my remark were I had now found someone I could care for. Thank heaven," were the expression, "I have now found someone I can care for. You don't eat enough, sir, nor yet drink." "Is that what you found your supposition on, Mrs. Crupp?" said I. "Sir," said Mrs. Crupp in a tone approaching to severity, "I've laundressed other young gentlemen besides yourself. A young gentleman may be over-careful of himself, or he may be under-careful of himself. He may brush his hair too regular or too unregular. He may wear his boots much too large for him or much too small. That is according as the young gentleman has his original character formed. But let him go to which extreme he may, sir, there's a young lady in both of them." Mrs. Crupp shook her head in such a determined manner that I had not an inch of vantage ground left. "It was but the gentleman which died here before yourself," said Mrs. Crupp, "that fell in love with a barmaid and had his waistcoats took in directly, though much swelled by drinking." "Mrs. Crupp," said I must beg you not to connect the young lady in my case with a barmaid or anything of that sort, if you please." "Mr. Copperfull," returned Mrs. Crupp, "I'm a mother myself, and not likely. I ask your pardon, sir, if I intrude. I should never wish to intrude where I were not welcome, but you are a young gentleman, Mr. Copperfull, and my advice to you is to cheer up, sir, to keep a good heart, and to know your own value. If you was to take to something, sir," said Mrs. Crupp, "if you was to take to skittles now, which is healthy, you might find it divert your mind and do you good." With these words, Mrs. Crupp, affecting to be very careful of the brandy, which was all gone, thanked me with a majestic curtsy and retired. As her figure disappeared into the gloom of the entry, this counsel certainly presented itself to my mind in the light of a slight liberty on Mrs. Crupp's part. But at the same time I was content to receive it in another point of view as a word to the wise, and a warning in future to keep my secret better. Chapter 27. Tommy Traddles. It may have been in consequence of Mrs. Crupp's advice, and perhaps for no better reason than because there was a certain similarity in the sound of the words Skittles and Traddles, that it came into my head next day to go and look after Traddles. The time he'd mentioned was more than out, and he lived in a little street near the Veterinary College at Camden Town, which was principally tenanted, as one of our clerks who lived in that direction informed me, by gentlemen students who bought live donkeys and made experiments on those quadrupeds in their private apartments. Having obtained from this clerk a direction to the academic grove in question, I set out the same afternoon to visit my old schoolfellow. I found that the street was not as desirable a one as I could have wished it to be for the sake of Traddles. The inhabitants appeared to have a propensity to throw any little trifles they were not in want of into the road, which not only made it rank and sloppy, but untidy too, on account of the cabbage leaves. The refuse was not wholly vegetable either, for I myself saw a shoe, a doubled-up saucepan, a black bonnet, and an umbrella in various stages of decomposition, as I was looking out for the number I wanted. The general air of the place reminded me forcibly of the days when I lived with Mr. and Mrs. Micawber. An indescribable character of faded gentility that attached to the house I sought, and made it unlike all the other houses in the street, though they were all built on one monotonous pattern, and looked like the early copies of a blundering boy who was learning to make houses and had not yet got out of his cramped brick-and-mortar pothooks, reminded me still more of Mr. and Mrs. Micawber. Happening to arrive at the door as it was opened to the afternoon milkman, I was reminded of Mr. and Mrs. Micawber more forcibly yet. "Now," said the milkman to a very youthful servant girl, "has that there little bill of mine been heard on?" "Oh, master says he'll attend to it immediate," was the reply. "Because," said the milkman, going on as if he'd received no answer, and speaking, as I judged from his tone, rather for the edification of somebody within the house than of the youthful servant, an impression which was strengthened by his manner of glaring down the passage, "because that there little bill has been running so long that I begin to believe it's run away altogether and never won't be heard of. Now, I'm not going to stand it, you know," said the milkman, still throwing his voice into the house and glaring down the passage. As to his dealing in the mild article of milk, by the by, there never was a greater anomaly. His deportment would have been fierce in a butcher or a brandy merchant. The voice of the youthful servant became faint, but she seemed to me, from the action of her lips, again to murmur that it would be attended to immediate. "I'll tell you what," said the milkman, looking hard at her for the first time and taking her by the chin. "Are you fond of milk?"
"Yes, I likes it,"
she replied. "Good," said the milkman, "and you won't have none tomorrow, do you hear? Not a fragment of milk you won't have tomorrow." I thought she seemed upon the whole relieved by the prospect of having any today. The milkman, after shaking his head at her darkly, released her chin, and with anything rather than goodwill opened his can and deposited the usual quantity in the family jug. This done, he went away muttering, and uttered the cry of his trade next door in a vindictive shriek. "Does Mr. Traddles live here?" I then inquired. A mysterious voice from the end of the passage replied, "Yes." Upon which the youthful servant replied, "Yes." "Is he at home?" said I. Again the mysterious voice replied in the affirmative, and again the servant echoed it. Upon this I walked in, and in pursuance of the servant's directions, walked upstairs, conscious, as I passed the back parlour door, that I was surveyed by a mysterious eye, probably belonging to the mysterious voice. When I got to the top of the stairs, the house was only a story high above the ground floor, Traddles was on the landing to meet me. He was delighted to see me, and gave me welcome with great heartiness to his little room. It was in the front of the house, and extremely neat, though sparely furnished. It was his only room, I saw, for there was a sofa bedstead in it, and his blacking brushes and blacking were among his books, on the top shelf behind a dictionary. His table was covered with papers, and he was hard at work in an old coat. I looked at nothing that I know of, but I saw everything, even to the prospect of a church upon his china inkstand as I sat down, and this, too, was a faculty confirmed in me in the old Micawber times. Various ingenious arrangements he'd made for the disguise of his chest of drawers and the accommodation of his boots, his shaving-glass, and so forth, particularly impressed themselves upon me as evidences of the same Traddles who used to make models of elephants' dens in writing-paper to put flies in, and to comfort himself under ill usage with the memorable works of art I have so often mentioned. In a corner of the room was something neatly covered up with a large white cloth. I couldn't make out what that was. "Traddles," said I, shaking hands with him again after I'd sat down, "I'm delighted to see you." "I'm delighted to see you, Copperfield," he returned. "I'm very glad indeed to see you. It was because I was thoroughly glad to see you when we met in Ely Place, and was sure you were thoroughly glad to see me, that I gave you this address instead of my address at Chambers." "Oh, you have Chambers?" said I. "Why, I have the fourth of a room and a passage, and the fourth of a clerk," returned Traddles. "Three others and myself unite to have a set of chambers, to look business-like. And we quarter the clerk, too. Half a crown a week he costs me." His old, simple character and good temper, and something of his old unlucky fortune also, I thought, smiled at me in the smile with which he made this explanation. "It's not because I have the least pride, Copperfield, you understand," said Traddles, "that I don't usually give my address here. It's only on account of those who come to me who might not like to come here. For myself, I'm fighting my way on in the world against difficulties, and it would be ridiculous if I made a pretense of doing anything else." "You're reading for the bar," Mr. Waterbrook informed me, said I. "Why, yes," said Traddles, rubbing his hands slowly over one another. "I am reading for the bar. The fact is, I've just begun to keep my terms after a rather long delay. It's some time since I was articled, but the payment of that £100 was a great pull. A great pull," said Traddles with a wince, as if he'd had a tooth out. "Do you know what I can't help thinking of, Traddles, as I sit here looking at you?" I asked him. "No," said he. "That sky-blue suit you used to wear."
"Oh, to be sure," cried Traddles, laughing. "Tight in the arms and legs, you know, dear me. Well, those were happy times, weren't they?"
"I think our schoolmaster might have made them happier without doing any harm to any of us, I acknowledge," I returned.
"Perhaps he might," said Traddles, "but dear me, there was a good deal of fun going on. Do you remember the nights in the bedroom, when we used to have the suppers, and when you used to tell the stories? And do you remember when I got caned for crying about Mr. Mel? Old Creakle. I should like to see him again, too." "He was a brute to you, Traddles," said I indignantly, for his good humour made me feel as if I'd seen him beaten but yesterday.
"Do you think so?" returned Traddles. "Really? Perhaps he was, rather, but it's all over a long while. Old Creakle."
"You were brought up by an uncle, then?" said I.
"Of course I was," said Traddles. "The one I was always going to write to, and always didn't, eh?" "Yes, I had an uncle then. He died soon after I left school."
"Indeed?"
"Yes. He was a retired, what do you call it, draper, cloth merchant, and had made me his heir, but he didn't like me when I grew up."
"Do you really mean that?" said I.
He was so composed that I fancied he must have some other meaning.
"Oh, dear, yes, Copperfield, I mean it," replied Traddles. "It was an unfortunate thing, but he didn't like me at all. He said I wasn't at all what he expected, and so he married his housekeeper."
"And what did you do?" I asked.
"I didn't do anything in particular," said Traddles. "I lived with them, waiting to be put out in the world, until his gout unfortunately flew to his stomach, and so he died. And so she married a young man, and so I wasn't provided for."
"Did you get nothing, Traddles, after all?"
"Oh, dear, yes," said Traddles. "I got £50. I'd never been brought up to any profession, and at first I was at a loss what to do for myself. However, I began, with the assistance of the son of a professional man who'd been to Salem House, Yawler, with his nose on one side. Do you recollect him?"
"No.
He hadn't been there with me,
all the noses were straight in my day.
It don't matter,
said Traddles. I began by means of his assistance to copy law writings. That didn't answer very well, and then I began to state cases for them and make abstracts and do that sort of work. For I'm a plodding kind of fellow, Copperfield, and had learnt the way of doing such things pithily. Well, that put it in my head to enter myself as a law student, and that ran away with all that was left of the £50. Yawler recommended me to one or two other offices, however, Mr. Waterbrook's for one, and I got a good many jobs. I was fortunate enough, too, to become acquainted with a person in the publishing way who was getting up an encyclopedia, and he set me to work, and indeed, glancing at his table, I am at work for him at this minute. I'm not a bad compiler, Copperfield, said Traddles, preserving the same air of cheerful confidence in all he said, but I have no invention at all, not a particle. I suppose there never was a young man with less originality than I have. As Traddles seemed to expect that I should assent to this as a matter of course, I nodded. And he went on with the same sprightly patience, I can find no better expression, as before. So, by little and little and not living high, I managed to scrape up the £100 at last, said Traddles, and thank heaven that's paid. Though it certainly was, said Traddles, wincing again as if he'd had another tooth out. A pull. I'm living by the sort of work I've mentioned still, and I hope one of these days to get connected with some newspaper, which would almost be the making of my fortune. Now, Copperfield, you are so exactly what you used to be with that agreeable face, and it's so pleasant to see you that I shan't conceal anything. Therefore, you must know that I am engaged. Engaged? Oh, Dora! She's a curate's daughter, said Traddles, 1 of 10 down in Devonshire. Yes. For he saw me glance involuntarily at the prospect on the inkstand. That's the church. You come round here to the left, out of this gate, tracing his finger along the inkstand, and exactly where I hold this pen, there stands the house, facing, you understand, towards the church. The delight with which he entered into these particulars didn't fully present itself to me until afterwards, for my selfish thoughts were making a ground plan of Mr. Spenlow's house and garden at the same moment. She's such a dear girl, said Traddles, a little older than me, but the dearest girl. I told you I was going out of town. I've been down there. I walked there and I walked back, and I had the most delightful time. I dare say ours is likely to be a rather long engagement, but our motto is wait and hope. We always say that. Wait and hope, we always say. And she would wait, Copperfield, till she was 60, any age you can mention for me. Traddles rose from his chair, and with a triumphant smile put his hand upon the white cloth I had observed. However, he said, it's not that we haven't made a beginning towards housekeeping. No, no, we've begun. We must get on by degrees, but we have begun. Here, drawing the cloth off with great pride and care, are 2 pieces of furniture to commence with, this flower pot and stand she bought herself. You put that in a parlour window, said Traddles, falling a little back from it to survey it with a greater admiration, with a plant in it, and there you are. This little round table with the marble top, it's 2 feet 10 in circumference, I bought. You want to lay a book down, you know, or somebody comes to see you or your wife and wants a place to stand a cup of tea upon, and there you are again, said Traddles. It's an admirable piece of workmanship, firm as a rock. I praised them both highly, and Traddles replaced the covering as carefully as he removed it. It's not a great deal towards the furnishings, said Traddles, but it's something. The tablecloths and pillowcases and articles of that kind are what discourage me most, Copperfield. So does the ironmongery, candle boxes and gridirons and that sort of necessaries, because those things tell and mount up. However, wait and hope, and I assure you she's the dearest girl. I'm quite certain of it, said I. In the meantime, said Traddles, coming back to his chair, and this is the end of my prosing about myself, I get on as well as I can. I don't make much, but I don't spend much. In general, I board with the people downstairs, who are very agreeable people indeed. Both Mr. and Mrs. Micawber have seen a good deal of life and are excellent company. My dear Traddles, I quickly exclaimed, what are you talking about? Traddles looked at me as if he wondered what I was talking about. "Mr. and Mrs. Micawber," I repeated. "Why, I'm intimately acquainted with them." An opportune double knock at the door, which I knew well from old experience in Windsor Terrace, and which nobody but Mr. Micawber could ever have knocked at that door, resolved any doubt in my mind as to their being my old friends. I begged Traddles to ask his landlord to walk up. Traddles accordingly did so over the banister, and Mr. Micawber, not a bit changed, his tights, his stick, his shirt collar and his eyeglass, all the same as ever, came into the room with a genteel and youthful air.
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Traddles," said Mr. Micawber with the old roll in his voice, as he checked himself in humming a soft tune. "I was not aware that there was any individual alien to this tenement in your sanctum."
Mr. Micawber slightly bowed to me and pulled up his shirt collar. "How do you do, Mr. Micawber?" said I.
"Sir," said Mr. Micawber, "you are exceedingly obliging. I am in statu quo."
"And Mrs. Micawber?" I pursued.
"Sir," said Mr. Micawber, "she is also, thank God, in statu quo."
"And the children, Mr. Micawber?"
"Sir," said Mr. Micawber, "I rejoice to reply that they are likewise in the enjoyment of salubrity."
All this time Mr. Micawber hadn't known me in the least, though he'd stood face to face with me. But now, seeing me smile, he examined my features with more attention, fell back, cried, "Is it possible? Have I the pleasure of again beholding Copperfield?" and shook me by both hands with the utmost fervour.
"Good heavens, Mr. Traddles," said Mr. Micawber, "to think that I should find you acquainted with the friend of my youth, the companion of earlier days. My dear,"
calling over the banisters to Mrs. Micawber, while Traddles looked with reason not a little amazed at this description of me,
"here is a gentleman in Mr. Traddles' apartment whom he wishes to have the pleasure of presenting to you, my love."
Mr. Micawber immediately reappeared and shook hands with me again.
"And how is our good friend the doctor, Copperfield?"
said Mr. Micawber, "and all the circle at Canterbury."
"I have none but good accounts of them," said I. "I'm most delighted to hear it," said Mr. Micawber. "It was at Canterbury where we last met, within the shadow, I may figuratively say, of that religious edifice immortalised by Chaucer, which was anciently the resort of pilgrims from the remotest corners of... In short," said Mr. Micawber, "in the immediate neighbourhood of the cathedral."
I replied that it was. Mr. Micawber continued talking as volubly as he could, but not, I thought, without showing by some marks of concern in his countenance that he was sensible of sounds in the next room, as of Mrs. Micawber washing her hands and hurriedly opening and shutting drawers that were uneasy in their action.
"You find us, Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber with one eye on Traddles, "at present established on what may be designated as a small and unassuming scale. But you are aware that I have, in the course of my career, surmounted difficulties and conquered obstacles. You are no stranger to the fact that there have been periods of my life when it has been requisite that I should pause until certain expected events should turn up, when it has been necessary that I should fall back before making what I trust I shall not be accused of presumption in terming a spring. The present is one of those momentous stages in the life of man. You find me fallen back for a spring, and I have every reason to believe that a vigorous leap will shortly be the result."
I was expressing my satisfaction when Mrs. Micawber came in, a little more slatternly than she used to be, or so she seemed now to my unaccustomed eyes, but still with some preparation of herself for company, and with a pair of brown gloves on.
"My dear," said Mr. Micawber, leading her towards me, "here is a gentleman of the name of Copperfield who wishes to renew his acquaintance with you."
It would have been better, as it turned out, to have led gently up to this announcement, for Mrs. Micawber, being in a delicate state of health, was overcome by it, and was taken so unwell that Mr. Micawber was obliged, in great trepidation, to run down to the water butt in the backyard and draw a basinful to lave her brow with. She presently revived, however, and was really pleased to see me. We had half an hour's talk all together, and I asked her about the twins, who she said were grown great creatures. And after Master and Miss Micawber, whom she described as absolute giants, but they were not produced on that occasion. Mr. Micawber was very anxious that I should stay to dinner. I shouldn't have been averse to do so, but that I imagined I detected trouble, and calculation relative to the extent of the cold meat in Mrs. Micawber's eye. I therefore pleaded another engagement, and observing that Mrs. Micawber's spirits were immediately lightened, I resisted all persuasion to forego it. But I told Traddles and Mr. and Mrs. Micawber that before I could think of leaving, they must appoint a day when they would come and dine with me. The occupations to which Traddles stood pledged rendered it necessary to fix a somewhat distant one, but an appointment was made for the purpose that suited us all, and then I took my leave. Mr. Micawber, under pretense of showing me a nearer way than that by which I'd come, accompanied me to the corner of the street. Being anxious, he explained to me, to say a few words to an old friend in confidence. "My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, "I need hardly tell you that to have beneath our roof, under existing circumstances, a mind like that which gleams, if I may be allowed the expression, which gleams in your friend Traddles, is an unspeakable comfort. With a washerwoman who exposes hardbake for sale in her parlour window dwelling next door, and a Bow Street officer residing over the way, you may imagine that his society is a source of consolation to myself and to Mrs. Micawber. I am at present, my dear Copperfield, engaged in the sale of corn upon commission. It is not an avocation of a remunerative description. In other words, it does not pay. And some temporary embarrassments of a pecuniary nature have been the consequence. I am, however, delighted to add that I have now an immediate prospect of something turning up. I'm not at liberty to say in what direction, which I trust will enable me to provide permanently, both for myself and for your friend Traddles, in whom I have an unaffected interest. You may perhaps be prepared to hear that Mrs. Micawber is in a state of health which renders it not wholly improbable that an addition may be ultimately made to those pledges of affection which... In short, to the infantine group. Mrs. Micawber's family have been so good as to express their dissatisfaction with this state of things. I have merely to observe that I am not aware it is any business of theirs, and that I repel that exhibition of feeling with scorn and with defiance. Mr. Micawber then shook hands with me again and left me.
This ends side 2 of cassette 13 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 14.
"28. Mr. Micawber's Gauntlet. Until the day arrived on which I was to entertain my newly found old friends, I lived principally on Dora and coffee. In my lovelorn condition, my appetite languished, and I was glad of it, for I felt as though it would have been an act of perfidy towards Dora to have a natural relish for my dinner. The quantity of walking exercise I took was not in this respect attended with its usual consequence, as the disappointment counteracted the fresh air. I have my doubts, too, founded on the acute experience acquired at this period of my life, whether a sound enjoyment of animal food can develop itself freely in any human subject who is always in torment from tight boots. I think the extremities require to be at peace before the stomach will conduct itself with vigour. On the occasion of this domestic little party, I did not repeat my former extensive preparations. I merely provided a pair of soles, a small leg of mutton, and a pigeon pie. Mrs. Crupp broke out into rebellion on my first bashful hint in reference to the cooking of the fish and joint, and said, with a dignified sense of injury,
"No, no, sir, you will not ask me such a thing, for you're better acquainted with me than to suppose me capable of doing what I cannot do with ample satisfaction to my own feelings."
But in the end a compromise was effected, and Mrs. Crupp consented to achieve this feat, on condition that I dined from home for a fortnight afterwards. And here I may remark that what I underwent from Mrs. Crupp, in consequence of the tyranny she established over me, was dreadful. I never was so much afraid of anyone. We made a compromise of everything. If I hesitated, she was taken with that wonderful disorder which was always lying in ambush in her system, ready, at the shortest notice, to prey upon her vitals. If I rang the bell impatiently after half a dozen unavailing modest pulls and she appeared at last, which was not by any means to be relied upon, she would appear with a reproachful aspect, sink breathless on a chair near the door, lay her hand upon her nankeen bosom, and become so ill that I was glad at any sacrifice of brandy or anything else to get rid of her. If I objected to having my bed made at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which I do still think an uncomfortable arrangement, one motion of her hand towards the same nankeen region of wounded sensibility was enough to make me falter an apology. In short, I would have done anything in an honourable way rather than give Mrs. Crupp offence, and she was the terror of my life. I bought a second-hand dumb waiter for this dinner party in preference to re-engaging the handy young man, against whom I had conceived a prejudice in consequence of meeting him in the Strand one Sunday morning in a waistcoat remarkably like one of mine, which had been missing since the former occasion. The young gal was re-engaged, but on the stipulation that she should only bring in the dishes and then withdraw to the landing-place beyond the outer door, where a habit of sniffing she had contracted would be lost upon the guests, and where her retiring on the plates would be a physical impossibility. Having laid in the materials for a bowl of punch, to be compounded by Mr. Micawber, having provided a bottle of lavender water, 2 wax candles, a paper of mixed pins and a pincushion, to assist Mrs. Micawber in her toilette at my dressing-table, having also caused the fire in my bedroom to be lighted for Mrs. Micawber's convenience, and having laid the cloth with my own hands, I awaited the result with composure. At the appointed time, my 3 visitors arrived together. Mr. Micawber, with more shirt collar than usual and a new ribbon to his eyeglass, Mrs. Micawber with her cap in a whitey-brown paper parcel, Traddles carrying the parcel and supporting Mrs. Micawber on his arm. They were all delighted with my residence. When I conducted Mrs. Micawber to my dressing-table and she saw the scale on which it was prepared for her, she was in such raptures that she called Mr. Micawber to come in and look. "My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, "this is luxurious. This is a way of life which reminds me of the period when I was myself in a state of celibacy, and Mrs. Micawber had not yet been solicited to plight her faith at the hymeneal altar." "He means solicited by him, Mr. Copperfield," said Mrs. Micawber archly. "He cannot answer for others." "My dear," returned Mr. Micawber with sudden seriousness, "I have no desire to answer for others. I am too well aware that when in the inscrutable degrees of fate you were reserved for me, it is possible you may have been reserved for one destined, after a protracted struggle, at length to fall a victim to pecuniary involvements of a complicated nature. I understand your allusion, my love. I regret it, but I can bear it." "Micawber," exclaimed Mrs. Micawber in tears, "have I deserved this? I, who have never deserted you, who never will desert you, Micawber." "My love," said Mr. Micawber, much affected, "you will forgive, and our old and tried friend Copperfield will, I'm sure, forgive the momentary laceration of a wounded spirit made sensitive by a recent collision with a minion of power. In other words, with a ribald turncock attached to the waterworks, and will pity, not condemn, its excesses." Mr. Micawber then embraced Mrs. Micawber and pressed my hand, leaving me to infer from this broken illusion that his domestic supply of water had been cut off that afternoon in consequence of default in the payment of the company's rates. To divert his thoughts from this melancholy subject, I informed Mr. Micawber that I relied upon him for a bowl of punch and led him to the lemons. His recent despondency, not to say despair, was gone in a moment. I never saw a man so thoroughly enjoy himself amid the fragrance of lemon peel and sugar, the odour of burning rum and the steam of boiling water, as Mr. Micawber did that afternoon. It was wonderful to see his face shining at us out of a thin cloud of these delicate fumes as he stirred and mixed and tasted and looked as if he were making, instead of punch, a fortune for his family down to the last posterity. As to Mrs. Micawber, I don't know whether it was the effect of the cap, or the lavender water, or the pins, or the fire, or the wax candles, but she came out of my room, comparatively speaking, lovely. And the lark was never gayer than that excellent woman. I suppose, I never ventured to inquire, but I suppose that Mrs. Crupp, after frying the soles, was taken ill, because we broke down at that point. The leg of mutton came up very red within and very pale without, besides having a foreign substance of a gritty nature sprinkled over it, as if it had fallen into the ashes of that remarkable kitchen fireplace. But we were not in a condition to judge of this fact from the appearance of the gravy, forasmuch as the young gal had dropped it all upon the stairs, where it remained, by the by, in a long train until it was worn out. The pigeon pie wasn't bad, but it was a delusive pie, the crust being like a disappointing head, phrenologically speaking, full of lumps and bumps with nothing particular underneath. In short, the banquet was such a failure that I should have been quite unhappy. About the failure, I mean, for I was always unhappy about Dora. If I'd not been relieved by the great good humour of my company, and by a bright suggestion from Mr. Micawber. "My dear friend Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, "accidents will occur in the best regulated families, and in families not regulated by that pervading influence which sanctifies, while it enhances the, I would say, in short, by the influence of woman in the lofty character of wife, they may be expected with confidence and must be borne with philosophy. If you will allow me to take the liberty of remarking that there are few comestibles better in their way than a devil, and that I believe, with a little division of labour, we could accomplish a good one if the young person in attendance could produce a gridiron, I would put it to you that this little misfortune may be easily repaired. There was a gridiron in the pantry on which my morning rasher of bacon was cooked. We had it in a twinkling, and immediately applied ourselves to carrying Mr. Micawber's idea into effect. The division of labour to which he'd referred was this. Traddles cut the mutton into slices. Mr. Micawber, who could do anything of this sort to perfection, covered them with pepper, mustard, salt and cayenne. I put them on the gridiron, turned them with a fork, and took them off under Mr. Micawber's directions, and Mrs. Micawber heated and continually stirred some mushroom ketchup in a little saucepan. When we had slices enough done to begin upon, we fell to with our sleeves till, tucked up at the wrists, more slices sputtering and blazing on the fire, and our attention divided between the mutton on our plates and the next relay of mutton then preparing. What with the novelty of this cookery, the excellence of it, the bustle of it, the frequent starting up to look after it, the frequent sitting down to dispose of it, as the crisp slices came off the gridiron hot and hot, the being so busy, so flushed with the fire, so amused, and in the midst of such a tempting noise and savour, we reduced the leg of mutton to the bone. My own appetite came back miraculously. I'm ashamed to record it, but I really believe I forgot Dora for a little while. I'm satisfied that Mr. and Mrs. Micawber could not have enjoyed the feast more if they had sold a bed to provide it. Traddles laughed as heartily almost the whole time as he ate and worked. Indeed, we all did, all at once. And I dare say
There never was a greater success. We were at the height of our enjoyment, and were all busily engaged in our several departments, endeavouring to bring the last batch of slices to a state of perfection that should crown the feast, when I was aware of a strange presence in the room, and my eyes encountered those of the staid Littimer, standing hat in hand before me. "What's the matter?" I involuntarily asked. "I beg your pardon, sir. I was directed to come in. Is my master not here, sir?"
"No."
"Have you not seen him, sir?"
"No." "Don't you come from him?"
"Not immediately so, sir."
"Did he tell you you would find him here?"
"Not exactly so, sir, but I should think he might be here tomorrow, as he's not been here today."
"Is he coming up from Oxford?"
"I beg, sir," he returned respectfully, "that you will be seated and allow me to do this."
With which he took the fork from my unresisting hand and bent over the gridiron, as if his whole attention were concentrated on it. We shouldn't have been much discomposed, I dare say, by the appearance of Steerforth himself, but we became in a moment the meekest of the meek before his respectable serving man. Mr. Micawber, humming a tune to show that he was quite at ease, subsided into his chair with the handle of a hastily concealed fork sticking out of the bosom of his coat, as if he had stabbed himself. Mrs. Micawber put on her brown gloves and assumed a genteel languor. Traddles ran his greasy hands through his hair, and stood it bolt upright and stared in confusion at the tablecloth. As for me, I was a mere infant at the head of my own table, and hardly ventured to glance at the respectable phenomenon who had come from heaven knows where to put my establishment to rights. Meanwhile he took the mutton off the gridiron, and gravely handed it round. We all took some, but our appreciation of it was gone, and we merely made a show of eating it. As we severally pushed away our plates, he noiselessly removed them and set on the cheese. He took that off, too, when it was done with, cleared the table, piled everything on the dumb waiter, gave us our wine glasses, and of his own accord wheeled the dumb waiter into the pantry. All this was done in a perfect manner, and he never raised his eyes from what he was about. Yet his very elbows, when he had his back towards me, seemed to teem with the expression of his fixed opinion that I was extremely young. "Can I do anything more, sir?" I thanked him and said no, but would he take no dinner himself?
"None. I'm obliged to you, sir."
"Is Mr. Steerforth coming from Oxford?"
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"Is Mr. Steerforth coming from Oxford?"
"I should imagine that he might be here tomorrow, sir. I rather thought he might have been here today, sir. The mistake is mine, no doubt, sir."
"If you should see him first," said I.
"If you'll excuse me, sir, I don't think I shall see him first."
"In case you do," said I, "pray say that I'm sorry he wasn't here today, as an old schoolfellow of his was here."
"Indeed, sir."
And he divided a bow between me and Traddles with a glance at the latter. He was moving softly to the door when, in a forlorn hope of saying something naturally, which I never could to this man, I said, "Oh, Littimer."
"Sir?"
"Did you remain long at Yarmouth that time?"
"Not particularly so, sir."
"You saw the boat completed?"
"Yes, sir. I remained behind on purpose to see the boat completed."
"I know." He raised his eyes to mine respectfully. "Mr. Steerforth has not seen it yet, I suppose?"
"I really can't say, sir."
"I think, but I really can't say, sir. I wish you good night, sir." He comprehended everybody present in the respectful bow with which he followed these words, and disappeared. My visitors seemed to breathe more freely when he was gone, but my own relief was very great. For besides the constraint arising from that extraordinary sense of being at a disadvantage, which I always had in this man's presence, my conscience had embarrassed me with whispers that I had mistrusted his master, and I could not repress a vague, uneasy dread that he might find it out. How was it, having so little in reality to conceal, that I always did feel as if this man were finding me out? Mr. McCormick roused me from this reflection, which was blended with a certain remorseful apprehension of seeing Steerforth himself, by bestowing so many